Okay. So today I'd like to tell you, maybe by in the very beginning, a very, very brief and quick overview of the intrinsic spin qualifier, but I'd like to spend the most of my time to tell you today about the quantum spin Hall effect and the associated edge states, which we call helical liquids. So this work is done in collaboration with my group of students and postdocs at Stanford. I will give you a set of references, which we can. So basically, it's the papers on intrinsic spin Hall effect in a bulk insulator, which basically starts the business of of looking at quantum spin Hall effect, and then the no vertex correction in whole gas. Quantum spin Hall effect in semiconductor strained, and this is quantum spin Hall effect in inverted band gap materials such as mercury telluride, and the work on helical liquids as the edge states of the quantum spin Hall liquid. The subject of quantum spin Hall effect, there's also very interesting discussions on graphene, which I will not spend most of my time on, maybe only one slide touching upon it. So this, at least the way we started looking at the subject, is try to think about all possible generalizations of the quantum Hall effect. In two dimensions, they exist the quantum Hall effect in the presence of a magnetic field. The current is equals to the vector cross product of E and B, and the conductivity is purely quantized or independent of any disorder in the system. But a very natural generalization is basically the idea to replace this magnetic field by the spin. So therefore, the prediction of the spin current induced by the electric field. And when we say intrinsic spin Hall effect, it refers to the fact that because both the spin current and the electric field are even under time reversal, so the constant of proportionality can be purely independent of dissipative quantities such as mean free path, and only depend on the intrinsic properties of the system. So now for something like the gallium arsenide, you can do a calculation of what the intrinsic spin Hall effect is, do a Kubo formula calculation of the spin current induced by electric field, and the conductivity is equal to the difference. So if in the gallium arsenide, there's both the light hole and the heavy hole band, at a given Fermi energy, you get both the heavy hole Fermi momenta and the light hole Fermi momenta, and the intrinsic spin Hall effect in this system is proportional to the difference between these two Fermi momenta. This formula will become very important for us as a hint to try to see how we can possibly maximize the intrinsic spin Hall effect by band engineering or by naturally selecting materials at which there's the maximal difference between these two Fermi momenta. Yeah.
So I just want this question about motivation.
Yeah.
So the ordinary Hall effect also doesn't involve dissipation.
Right. But so that's also intrinsic.
Yes.
That's why I put the analogy between the two.
Like you made an analogy based on the fact that the spin is odd under time.
Yeah, but so there you also have a magnetic field, right? Therefore, the constant of proportionality can be independent of this order.
Okay.
Right. Right, because here you have a magnetic. So if I look at current times magnetic field, it transforms like the spin current. So it has certain compared with the ordinary ohmic conductivity, it has to because current is odd under time reversal, electric field is even. The ordinary Joule conductivity or any generalization, higher order generalization of it, has to involve quantities involving disorder. So that business is quite exciting because it leads to possibility of electric field manipulation of spin. Dissipationless response coming from topological origin, and the topological aspect is what I will focus much more later on. So in the beginning, there was some controversy about these predictions, whether the disorder will spoil this prediction of the intrinsic spin Hall effect. It turns out this issue is now completely settled within the theoretical community. It is known that in the Luttinger model or the two-dimensional whole gas, the vertex corrections are identically zero. So in the clean limit, one goes back to this result. Whereas in the Rochebaugh model, it's a little bit singular. The vertex correction cancels the intrinsic spin Hofer. Now, the spin Hofer, there has been two experiments very quickly. The important thing for someone not non-experts in this field is that in the UC Santa Barbara group, they observed by passing an electric field, you see spin accumulation on both sides. But it now turns out that it's also theories have more or less converged. It turns out intrinsic and extrinsic theories predict the opposite sign. So I really hope that one of the, maybe the mission of this workshop is to settle to see whether we can really talk to experimentalists and get a definite sign, and then in principle, the whether it's intrinsic or extrinsic can be determined experimentally. So far, there's still some experimental difficulties in determining the absolute sign. The other experiment is done by Jürg Wunderlich's group in the two-dimensional whole gas, where you pass the electric field, leads to spin accumulation at the boundary, and the particle-hole recombination turns the spin into light. Now that experiment is done in a clean limit, where disorder broadening is less than the spin splitting. It's also shown theoretically that in the two-dimensional whole gas, the vertex correction is identically zero. So it's a system which is which could be a nice candidate for observing the intrinsic spin Hall effect. So now we have these all these three types of Hall effect are observed experimentally. The ordinary Hall effect in the presence of magnetic field passing a current leads to a charge accumulation or voltage. You can also have anonymous Hall effect without external magnetic field when you pass a current. It leads to both a charge accumulation and spin accumulation at the boundary. But in the pure spin Hall effect, there's no breaking of time reversal symmetry and no charge accumulation at these two boundaries, but a spin accumulation. So given the, well, of course, this issue of intrinsic versus extrinsic will still needs to be completely settled. But we as theorists like to move on and see what's the next frontier in this business. And you know, there's a quantized version of the ordinary Hall effect. So the most natural question is whether the spin Hall effect can be, there's a quantum regime of the spin Hall effect. So that will be the main focus of my talk today. So now besides, of course, quantum Hall effect is more interesting than ordinary Hall effect. So we might expect quantum spin Hall effect is also more interesting than the ordinary. The spin Hall effect, whether it's intrinsic or extrinsic in the metallic regime. But also, for those people in the audience, maybe from the other workshop, I'd like to tell you that it's much, much easier to understand quantum spin Hall effect because there are far fewer degrees of freedom, there are more better defined topological classifications of them, and it's easier to just understand it. Yeah.
How you define extrinsic and intrinsic?
Extrinsic coming from disorder scattering, spin orbit scattering of charge carriers by disorder potential. Intrinsic is in the limit when disorder is completely goes to zero. This is a very strange phenomenon. If you know, in ordinary Ohmic conductivity, when you let disorder to go completely zero, there's no well-defined conductivity. But however, the spin Hall conductivity is well-defined in the limit where disorder goes to zero. That's the difference.
That's in the Kubo phenomenon.
Yeah.
But actually, it's almost more than an intrinsic effect.
Yeah.
Appears when the disorder is extremely strong, so that the displacement of the frame C is small, so it is closer to equilibrium.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Actually, when we try to do calculations for the non-historic
effect, yeah.
Experiment.
Yeah.
Always have to. It's always in the disorder side or scattering side.
Yeah, but maybe the operational definition is that the constant of proportionality or the conductivity is independent of the disorder.
The experimental operational definition is that skew scattering.
Yeah.
Diverge,
So that's therefore it's for that reason. I believe it's in a metallic system there are lots of very tricky orders of limits. That's another reason we want to go into a system where there's a nice bulk gap, where everything becomes much cleaner defined, and then you can work backwards. So for those who are uninitiated, actually, what I'm going to talk about next, I hope that most people can follow, even if you don't know the subject, because it's going to start very elementary. So I'm going to first, before I talk about quantum spin Hall effect, I'd like to introduce the subject of quantum anonymous Hall effect. So let's try to understand what are the basic ingredients of the quantum Hall effect. It requires time reversal symmetry breaking. It requires a bulk gap, and it requires gapless chiral edge states. However, what is not required is a magnetic field. So far, all quantum Hall effect has been observed in the presence of the external magnetic field. But we predict that there are certain band structures which typically will involve something like a ferromagnetic insulator, in which the time reversal symmetry is broken by the ferromagnetic moments. But it has a topologically non-trivial band gap, and it will have gapless chiral edge states, chirality coming from the breaking of time reversal symmetry in a ferromagnet, for example. And there are rigorous theorems relating the bulk band gap to the chiral edge states. Now, these phenomena can be understood very, very simply, even if you are completely outside of this field, by only one slide. So let's imagine the most simplest possible Hamiltonian for two bands. If you have a simple Hamiltonian for two bands, then the Hamiltonian can always, because Hamiltonian is a Hermitian operator, it can always be expanded in the space of Pauli matrices. So this is the first term times the identity matrix, and the second term expanded in the Pauli matrix. If I give you general functions of epsilon as three functions of d, this is the most general two-band Hamiltonian you can write down. And we can think of some examples. For example, we can imagine that we have a tight binding model. So this Fourier transform of the tight binding model will give you a cosine term in the ordinary band structure. But then you can imagine that because this thing becomes ferromagnetic, there's a Zeeman, spontaneous Zeeman term, and there's a term which gives the opposite sign of the effective mass for up and down spin. So I'd like to show you how this might come about. So imagine you have an ordinary, any ordinary semiconductor, but with possibly a narrow band gap. So now suppose this semiconductor becomes ferromagnetic, then each band will be spin split into two bands. So the downspin will be split into two bands, and the upspin will be split. So the upper valence band will be spin up and spin down split, and the lower valence band will be spin up and spin down split. So this is a situation where you see the downspin and the upspin, as they cross, will have the opposite sign of the dispersion, and that's captured by this kind of term. Okay. So then at this crossing point, there's a degeneracy. So then if the system has a very small, even if you have a small amount of Rochebauer type of string orbit coupling, it will remove this degeneracy. Okay, so it will open up a gap. So this is a description of a two-band insulator. So this is the upper band and this is the lower band. Originally we have four bands, but effectively it is now described by two bands. But now you see this has a very interesting configuration. At the center of the Brillouin zone, when you look at the occupied band, it's spin up. At the boundary of the Brillouin zone, it's spin down. And in between, because it's the Rochebauer spin orbit coupling, which is removing the degeneracy, it leads to spin, which is points in the plane. But furthermore, we know that Rochebauer spin orbit coupling has something like a P wave type of form. So when you look at this configuration in momentum space from top down, you will actually, we'll show that later, you will see this actually looks like a vortex configuration of the spin in momentum space. But anyway, so this is a concrete possible realization of such kind of a two-band model. But if you have this two-band model, and if you have, then you can compute what is the Hall, charge Hall conductivity. It is given by this formula. Now, if you are in a situation where these two bands give you an insulator, namely the maxima of the valence band is less than the minima of the conduction band, then this describes the insulator, and only one of the n is one. One of the n is one; the other n is completely zero. So one band becomes fully occupied. So then, this ordinary Kubo formula for charge hole conductivity reduces to a following formula. So this d is what characterizes these two band. Band structure. It's when you expand the Hamiltonian, it's in the part that's proportional to the Pauli matrix. So when you look at the charge hole conductivity, it's a two-dimensional integral over the Brillouin zone, but times this nice topological formula. And that is nothing but the so-called Skirmion number in momentum space in the Brillouin zone. The Brillouin zone is a torus. The D is a three-dimensional vector. It describes a sphere, and that is nothing but the mapping from torus to sphere, which has to be an integer. So in this case, even the simplest two-band model without external magnetic field can give rise to a quantized spin Hall effect, quantized charge Hall effect, simply from this topological aspect of the band structure. And for example, in the previous tie binding model I introduced, you can compute for a certain parameter it's 1/2, for one certain parameter it's -1, and in some other parameter regime it's 0. But this object, when it's integrated for insulator, cannot give you anything other than a fractional number. It always has to be.
What kind of primitive are
So the physical model, let's look at this is a possible physical realization. Ordinary semiconductor, valence band and a conduction band, step number one. Step number two, this becomes a ferromagnet. So it splits, the valence band splits into the spin down band and spin up band. The conduction band splits into a spin up band and spin down band. They cross at this point. Okay, so there's a degeneracy at this point. But then, when the Rochebauer coupling comes in, the degeneracy will be removed. And then you originally have four bands, but now you only look at these two bands, which are closest to Fermi level. And so when Rochebauer removes the degeneracy and the Fermi level is in the middle, that describes, we claim, this is very simple to verify. It's not a claim, it's a theorem. That this is describing a topologically non-trivial.
That's about the energy
spectrum.
That's about energy.
Yes, spectrum. Yeah.
But it's applied to conductivity.
Yeah, and that's the formula. It's coming from here. So you have a Hamiltonian, and so what you replace K by K minus EA. And then you calculate, this is coming from the matrix elements.
But those matrix elements are matrix elements for transitions between different
bands. Only these two bands. Between these two bands.
Yeah, between those bands,
yeah.
But not inside the band.
And also inside the band. This is the complete formula. If I have a 2x2...
Are these vertical transitions...
I will neglect these remote bands. Only concentrate on these two bands. Within two-band model, you just compute the charge hole conductivity. So far I'm talking about quantized anonymous Hall effect, not yet about spin Hall effect. But you take this Hamiltonian, which I gave you a physical motivation, and then you replace K by K minus EA. Yeah.
The question is probably if you take all the K states into account, sum up over all K conditions.
Yeah. You have to sum over all K. Yes, K sums over all K in the Brillouin zone.
There's some rather exceptional consequences to this band structure.
Yeah.
This is essentially an exotonic insulator.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have some kind of commensurate characteristic in the system as well, right?
Why? No new periodicity. Only thing that's broken spontaneously is the spin rotation symmetry.
If it's an insulator or a semiconductor,
yeah,
then the gap has to close.
Yeah.
When the magnetic order turns on and open again.
Yeah, because of the Rochebauer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it closes because of emergence of ferromagnetism, but it opens up again because of the Rochebauer.
Do you expect a modification of this due to
cold.
Yeah, the effect of Hamiltonian is described by this Hamiltonian. We can solve everything that's to be known about it.
So this is a non-interacting electron model.
Yeah.
If we actually
the physical system is the system. So you can propose the instability we can investigate now.
I guess the other way, I'm curious about is there are 282 directions you can go.
Yeah. No, but in the end, after all this instability is settled, I'm occupying a lower. This becomes the new valence band. This becomes the new convex band.
If you put in some electron interaction, I guess with the band structure, there can be it's a complicated question. The interaction which leads to a different kind of interaction.
Yeah. It's absolutely essential that all k points are participating. That this thing only becomes an integer when you integrate every point in the Brillouin zone. But because it's an insulator, where only the lower valence band is occupied, so you're only occupying half of it. Right? Only half of the states, but every k point is integrated over. Right. So what physically is going on is that under this situation, we have a skirmion in momentum space. But the emergence of the skirmion is very natural because in the center, it's spin up and spin down. That's coming from the crossing of the ferromagnet, of the insulator when it becomes ferromagnetic. But a skirmion, mathematically, let me first explain what's a skirmion. It's a configuration, two-dimensional configuration. At the center of the skirmion, it's up. At infinity, it's pointing down. But in the middle, it's a vortex. So here, in momentum space, in the Brillouin zone, the reason at the center it's pointing up is because coming from the original conduction band being pulled down by the spin splitting. Why at the boundary it's spinning down? Because that's the original valence band that's being pulled up by the ferromagnetic instability. Now, why is the vortex in the middle? That's exactly the form of the Rochebach. When you look at Rochebach, it's a P wave-like thing. A P wave has one in number one. So therefore, by this series of transitions, we have created a skirmion in momentum space. And the skirmion in momentum space is characterized by topological integer. And that has a necessary consequence, that if the band structure is in such a way that it has a skirmion number, it has to imply, by the virtue of index theorem, an edge state. And in this case, it will predict that there are chiral edge states in the absence of any magnetic field in a ferromagnetic insulator. And that is a realization of the quantum anonymous Hall effect, as we propose. Is that clear?
So all the transfer is going through the
edge. And the edge are identical. Nothing in the bulk. And the bulk has a gap. And the edge. So this, I propose, is the simplest thing to start. Right? Once you understand that, you understand there's a lot of other things become easier to understand. So all the transport is occurring at the edge. The low energy effective theory is completely identical to that of ordinary quantum Hall effect. It's the only new ingredient is that it can be realized in an ordinary band insulator without external magnetic field, but it still have time reversal symmetry breaking come from ferromagnetic moments.
And edge states are similar to those in graphene.
No. These are similar to the quantum Hall effect. Graphene will come. We'll come back to that later. Yeah.
I have in mind that they propagate in both directions.
So far, I'm not talking about a spin. So far, I'm not talking about quantum spin Hall effect. So far, I'm talking about quantum anomalous Hall effect.
Quantum anomalous
Hall effect, which is a charged Hall effect.
Yeah, I looked in this picture.
Yeah.
Those two edges have different group velocities.
opposite, yeah.
Opposite.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but one is localized to one side, yeah, yeah, yeah. We will come to that, we will come to that. So far, this is identical, the low energy effective theory is identical to that of ordinary charged quantum Hall effect with lambda level in a magnetic field. But here, we don't have lambda levels, we have a band insulator, but the band insulator has a topologically non-trivial band gap coming from the thermal property, which I've explained where it could come from. Is that clear? This is going to be very important to, for the next step. Michael, more questions or?
Just, do you know of any material?
Yeah, we're working on the material. I this is the thing we theorists can give to material scientist people, because it's a phenomena which has not yet been observed in nature. All quantum Hall effects so far exist in the presence of magnetic field. We're working very closely to first principle calculation people, and we're very optimistic that it will be. Yeah.
I have a question concerning the spin. Is the spin for the Skirman still for this bands still
yeah.
a good quantum number?
Spin is not.
No.
No. No. But the Skirman number is. Okay, so now this gives a simple paradigm to understand quantum spin Hall effect, which is your question, what your question is about. Okay, so now, so let's come, so a little bit come back now to the subject of quantum spin Hall effect. So we calculated the intrinsic spin Hall effect for the gallium arsenide band structure, which has something like a conduction band, a heavy hole band, and a light hole band. And this formula that I showed you is very suggestive. It tells you that somehow the spin Hall effect, the intrinsic part of the spin Hall effect, is proportional to KFH minus KFL. So that tells you that they carry different topological quantity with respect to the spin Hall effect, because it's a difference. So how could you possibly maximize such effect? That's one question. The second question we asked in this paper with Murakami and Nagosa, not the original paper proposing the intrinsic spin Hall effect, but the paper on spin Hall insulator, which is basically the same as quantum spin Hall insulator. Then we asked the question, how can you, so first of all, by virtue of this argument we gave, because it's dissipationless, so therefore in principle it can exist for insulator, right? So there's nothing requires that it to be a conduction material. So then this is goes into a limit, maybe a gap opens up, and all these impurity effects will become inconsequential. So then we thought about this material, which is something like mercury terrarite or lead terrarite or alpha tin, which have a very strange band structure in the sense that this so-called S-band becomes below the Fermi level, so you can forget about it. But the light hole and heavy hole have the opposite sign of the effective mass. Now, of course, in this case, you should not call them light hole and heavy hole, but there's a well-defined meaning to them in the sense that this band has helicity, at least in the spherical approximation, has helicity plus or minus 3/2. And this band has helicity plus or minus 1/2. That's a precise characterization of these bands. And such material exists. And in this case, you can fully occupy the so-called heavy band without the subtraction of the light hole contribution. So in this case, the spin Hall effect should be maximal. We predicted, right? And in three-dimensional insulator is something like this. So the whole subject is now try to understand how can this thing be possible? What's the microscopic mechanism in which the spin is carried? And it turns out that this model, the previous model of quantum anonymous Hall effect I discussed, sheds a lot of light into the nature of the spin Hall conduction in this case.
What is A?
A is the lattice spacing. Yeah. So, but we're soon going to go into 2D. So let me do a little bit of mathematical preparation. You may feel this is unnecessary mathematics, but just bear with me for one moment. You will see that it becomes quite useful. So this is the Luttinger model, so that you get the K squared term, but you can have also K dot S squared term. Now the S here is important thing is that it's a spin 3/2 matrix. Where the spin 3/2 come from, it's basically, you think about atoms, you have the P level, and P level spin orbit coupled with the spin 1/2 of the electron splits into P 3/2 and P 1/2, P1 half is the so-called split off band, and the P3 half is the top of the valence band. So therefore, if you develop an effective theory for the top of valence band, you should use spin matrices, spin 3 half, describing the P3 half states. Now, this is S is now a 4 by 4 matrix. So if you take the square of the 4 by 4 matrix, you find only the symmetric combination occurs. So now, when you look at a symmetric combination of K, there are 6 possibilities. One possibility is just K squared. But there's 5 other, and this is nothing but the D wave form. Okay? So when you expand this out, there are 5 terms, which are the 5-dimensional D wave representation. And then there are also another 5 combinations of S, basically S1 times S2 and so on, similar to this D wave form. And it turns out very nicely that mathematically, the symmetric traceless combination of the spin 3 half matrices are isomorphic to the Dirac gamma matrices. So you can write down the Luttinger Hamiltonian in a very beautiful form. It's epsilon of k times d of k, where d is these 5 d vectors, times gamma a, where a goes from 1 to 5, and they're denoting the traceless symmetric combination of the spin S matrices. And then because the space of 4 by 4 matrices has 16 Hermitian matrices, this is 5 of them, but then you can also construct the anti-symmetric combination, which are basically, so this gamma matrix is nothing but a symmetric traceless combination of the S, and these 10 other matrices are either the 3S original spin operator, but then times the cubic form. And all these mathematics will become very, very important later on. In a case with inversion symmetry, you can only have this kind of form. So it's always enter in quadratic form, and D always enters also in quadratic form. But when you have something like a Rochebach field, let's say applied to a two-dimensional Mercury telluride, you can also have terms of this kind. So there are altogether 10 possible of these. But now the important thing is that this kind of thing can have a P-wave-like form, like the original Rochebach. And in the Luttinger, this kind of K has a D-wave-like form. And whether it's K or D, when you look at the previous topological formula, it's going to count the winding number. And P-wave usually counts winding number 1, and D-wave counts winding number 2. So this, whether it's D or P, plays a very, very crucial role in predicting the number of edge states in the system. So now let's look at, again, a real material, namely mercury telluride, for example. And it's described by this band structure Hamiltonian. In the bulk, they have the opposite. Plus minus 1/2 helicity state and plus minus 3/2 helicity state have the opposite effective mass. So therefore, you get a structure like this in the bulk. But if you put that into a confining quantum potential in 2 dimension, then a gap opens up. So this gap is perfectly tunable. Okay, and now this is a full state. So like previous discussion of quantum anonymous Hoffman, it's a 2-band model. This now becomes a 4-band model. So then it's a very interesting particular case is that when the confining quantum well is symmetric, then it has a z to minus z symmetry. Okay, so in this case, let's solve the band structure again. And then you find a very interesting situation that the effective Hamiltonian is now in the space of 4 by 4 matrices. But if you have this inversion symmetry, z goes to minus z, then you only have, then this 4 by 4 matrix become block diagonal. In each block, it takes exactly the same form as I have used in discussing the quantum anonymous Hall effect. So now it becomes very, very simple to understand what is quantum spin Hall effect. Quantum spin Hall effect, you can, in your mind, think of it as like a bilayer quantum anonymous Hall effect, where in the upper layer, it's seeing an up magnetic field or up ferromagnetic moment. And in the lower layer, there's a minus sign here. This minus sign will reflect into the charge core conductance also being flipping the sign. But in the lower layer, it is seeing the opposite ferromagnetic moment. So what do these two layers mean? These two layers actually mean nothing but the combination of 1/2 and plus 1/2 and minus 3/2 form like one layer, and minus 1/2 and plus 3/2 form the other layer. So in the case where the confining potential in two-dimensional Luttinger model for mercury telluride is inversion symmetric with respect to z equal to z.
Each of the gray team, not mercury telluride, I think so, because all the even power...
We will come to all that. We will come to all that discussion, yeah. But the important thing here, the distinction between these discussion and it will become apparently clear later, and graphene, is that these ones have D waveform, whereas in graphene will have P waveform. And when you look at this topological formula, when you integrate the winding number, it either gives you 2 or 1. But I'm going to discuss all that. But so far, this is very clear physics. So it basically, in this particular limit, we're talking about nothing but 2 quantum anonymous Hall effect. One seeing one seeing effective magnetic field up, and the other seeing effective magnetic field down. So therefore, in this system, when you compute the charge Hall conductivity, it will be 0. The two components cancel. When you compute the spin Hall conductivity, it's exactly given by this very beautiful formula. And original in this particular case, originally you have 5 d's, but in this particular symmetry case, 2 of the d components vanishes, and you only have a 3-dimensional d vector. So again, you can have a well-defined Skirmion number, which give rise to this. And it turns out this number n, well, after all, you still need to integrate and compute what is number n, and there comes to all this very important question, namely whether it's D wave or P wave. It's either give you 2 or it give you 1, because that's how much it's winding in the momentum space. And to the nature of the conduction of this particular case now it becomes very clear. It's coming from the edge states. You have a bulk band gap, but you have edge states. And these edge states are helical rather than chiral. And helical is defined in the following sense, that in the ordinary quantum Hall effect, you have, let's say, the minimal quantity you can have is one chiral edge going, let's say, in the clockwise fashion. But here, helical means spin up is going in a clockwise fashion, but spin down is going in a counterclockwise fashion. So at the edge, the minimal amount of edge states you have will be 2, it's different from ordinary one because it's helical in the sense there's a perfect correlation between spin and chirality of the propagation. And so at this level, the simplest way to view this entire business is that quantum spin Hall, there's a particular realization. In principle, you can realize this experimentally by putting a symmetric quantum well. It's nothing but 2-component charge quantum Hall effect, one seeing up magnetic field, the other seeing the down magnetic field. Now, here comes a very, very important new ingredient. So what is the global topology which protects this kind of quantum number? Now, this is actually, this Skirmion number definition is nice, but it does not, this kind of Skirmion number definition is nice, but it does not survive when you have interaction because it all refers to some one-body states. It does not survive disorder because K is not a well-defined quantum number in the presence of disorder. So is there a most general topological classification of this? And that goes back to some very nice work going back to Chen Yu, Thoulis, and Yongxi Wu. And the idea is that you can define Chern numbers using twisted boundary conditions. So the idea is that if you have any two-dimensional system, they can be wildly interacting, lots of disorder, but you can still define the following quantity. That we apply a twisted boundary condition in the x direction and in the y direction. So if you discuss something like ordinary Hall effect, you will be letting the hopping amplitude have e to the I theta y in the y direction and e to the I theta x in the x direction. But if you describe something like spin Hall effect, you can stick in a spin matrix here. So if you put a spin matrix along x direction and a charge matrix along y direction, this is the natural twisted boundary condition to define the context of spin Hall effect. And now, if you have the system has a band gap, you can always, but actually we generalize this even further to say that the hopping amplitude along the x direction can also change the amplitude rather than the phase. So most generally, the Hamiltonian is becomes a Hamiltonian for 3 parameters. And that's generally true, regardless whether how strong the system is interacting, how much disorder does it have. So then, when you try to compute the Berry phase, as I adiabatically move in the parameter space, not in momentum space anymore, in this parameter space, then I can compute a Berry phase. And if that Berry phase turns out to be an integer, you can compute the Berry curvature. So here we're adiabatically, we're computing many body wave function in the presence of interaction, in the presence of disorder, but you can still compute this quantity. That's the power of the Neil-Thales-Wu method. But then it gives you, by general theorem, it has to give you also an integer. So that is applicable for the discussion of spin Hall effect, because here you're just twisting theta x, not in charge space, but with a non-trivial spin matrix here in defining the twisted boundary condition. So if this integer is always well-defined, as long as the many-body system, including interaction, including disorder, has a gap. Now, if this has a gap, then this integer, this has to come out to be integer. And if it is an integer, it must mean that there's a singularity inside. And if there's a singularity inside, it must mean there's gapless edge states. Now, here comes a very interesting distinction between the charge Hall effect and the spin Hall effect. That distinction is that you can only prove that there's a gapless edge state somewhere in this with this toroidal boundary condition, and it's not necessary at I equals to zero. So it turns out that in the charge Hall effect, the gapless edge state, if this global topological quantum number is non-zero, it has to imply there's gapless edge state when I is equals to zero, when there's no talk between the two edge states in true open boundary condition. In the case of spin Hall effect, more generally, actually because the fact that the spin current is not conserved, the general theorem is still valid, but it predicts gapless edge state in the presence of the tunneling between the two. So there's a general topological classification of the spin Hall, quantum spin Hall effect in the presence of disorder and in the presence of interaction. Okay, so now it comes back to the question that Emmanuel has been keep asking, is that how many edge states do you have in this particular example of a Mercury Terrorite? And the important thing is that in the Mercury Terrorite, these are D wave functions, and when you integrate this number, you will get even number of fermion pairs. So the minimum you have is chiral spin up, anti-chiral spin down. But in this particular case, you will have even number of pairs. And in this case, if you turn on breaking of the mirror symmetry, then the degeneracy at this crossing point can be removed if you have even number. But then, we're after all talking about a two-dimensional system. So then in a two-dimensional system, you can apply a Rochebauer type of electric field. Then you will be introducing this kind of term, which are directly proportional. So you see the Luttinger terms are proportional to the square of the spin matrix. The Rochebauer type of term are linearly proportional to the spin matrix. And these DABs are linear in K, not quadratic in K. So therefore, even in this particular case, after this even number of pair degeneracy has been removed, only thing you need to do is to apply a Rochebauer field again, and that induces a linear K term, and that can reduce the even number or two pairs of fermion states into a single pair of fermion states. And that is controllable by band structure engineering. So this is the Mercury Terrorite material has very strong spin orbit coupling, so we know how to have a global classification of the topological properties of quantum spin Hall effect, and we know how to tune in between even number and odd number of edge state pairs in this particular case. So far this is the realization of quantum spin Hall without Langlau levels. Just like the difference between quantum Hall effect with Langlau level and quantum anonymous Hall effect without Langlau level, I just presented to you the quantum spin Hall effect without Langlau levels. But you can also have quantum spin Hall effect with Langlau levels. Now, how can that possibly work? So, for example, if you have a magnetic field, let's just review ordinary Langlau level physics, then you have a gauge potential, which is R cross B. And when you look at P square term, in particular interesting thing is you get this linear term, velocity dependent force basically responsible for the Lorentz force. Now, this kind of thing is usually very, very hard to get, but it turns out that spin orbit coupling can mimic and give rise to a term like this. Why? Let's look at the form of the spin orbit coupling, P cross grad V dot sigma. Let's consider the case where both the momentum and the electric field are lying in the plane. So then these are in the x direction, this is y direction, so sigma has to be along the z direction. But if I have an electric field which is radially distributed, then I exactly get P cross R. So if I have a spin orbit coupled system, but with in-plane electric field which is radially distributed, then this term is identical to this term, except for spin up component, I see this term with a positive B. But for spin down component, I will see this term because sigma Z matrix will give you minus one. I will say minus B. So that is in the case where the physics will exactly mimic to Landau level physics. But with spin up component seeing up magnetic field and spin down component seeing down magnetic field. Sorry. So in principle, you can realize this in something like a charged cylinder where the electric field is distributed radially. But we have a slightly better experimental realization, and that's by using the strain engineering. Because if you apply strain in two-dimensional system, this type of strain tensor, these type of strain tensor are similar to that of the electric field. So basically, the long story short is that strain-induced spin orbit coupling with a strain gradient can lead to a radially distributed electric field. So then in this case, you have upspin seeing one magnetic field and downspin seeing another magnetic field. And you can have quantized Hall effect for one component of the spin. You can have quantized Hall effect for the other component of spin. So the net effect is you have no quantized charge Hall effect, but you have a net quantized spin Hall effect. So quantum spin Hall effect, in many sense, is just seeing two components of quantum charge Hall effect with opposite sign of magnetic field. So for this concrete realization of the quantum spin Hall effect with strain, we need something like a strain gradient of 1% over 10 to 60 microns, but it still gets a relatively small Landau gap. But in principle, it is realizable. So I will put mercury tyrite as the first candidate because that is just coming from the ordinary spin orbit interaction. So then you can also discuss the low energy effective theory. It's described also by a double Chern-Simons term, very similar to people at the other workshops are talking about. And the minimal conductivity is 2 in units of E squared over H. So now this graphene is more coming from this kind of structure. And it has a very weak spin orbit coupling coming from hopping, spin dependent hopping along the next nearest neighbor. And ordinary graphene so far has a massless Dirac gap spectrum. But if you're really looking to this, so originally Haldane tried to see this using this to as a model to have quantized Hall effect without a magnetic field. But what it also boils down to is to have spin up seeing one type of magnetic field and spin down seeing the other type of effective magnetic field. So in net effect, graphene without any external magnetic field would not have any charge hole conductance, but have a spin hole conductance. Now the whole issue about graphene is how big that gap is. So you need to open up a gap at the Dirac point at K and K prime. And originally in the proposal by Charlie King and Mali, they estimated a pretty reasonably large, something or the order of 1 mV gap opened due to spin orbit coupling. But we have now, both our group and Alan McDonough's group have refined the calculation. Unfortunately, that gap turns out to be very, very small, something between 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. So I still find the most promising candidate is mercury telluride.
Both
milli electron volts, 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3 milli electron volts. Okay, so now it comes back to a, so in what sense is helical liquid different from any other liquid? So certainly it's different from ordinary chiral liquid, because chiral liquid only has one chirality. Helical liquid has both chirality, but has a perfect correlation between upspin being chiral, downspin being anti-chiral. The more interesting thing is that these two, the chiral and anti-chiral components, are Cramer's pairs of each other. Okay, so imagine if you look at only this one direction, you have a left mover and right mover. You say, oh, what's the difference between ordinary spinless fermions? If I have a spinless fermion, I put a Fermi energy somewhere, I have a plus Kf and minus Kf, and one is have positive group velocity, the other has negative velocity. It will have two channels, both counterpropagating. What's the difference? There's a very, very important difference in terms of the time reversal property. Okay, so we learned in elementary quantum mechanics at graduate level, we learned that time reversal operation in quantum mechanics is anti-unitary operator T, but it has two different classes. One class has T squared equals to 1. The other class has T squared equals to minus 1. You can only prove the Cramer's theorem to have doublets when T squared is equals to minus 1, or when you have half integral spin fermions. So in the case of spinless fermions, you cannot say any the left mover and right mover are not time reverse pair of each other. They are not enforced by the Cramer's theorem. In the case of helical liquid, this one is exactly the Cramer's pair of the other. So that has a profound consequence. T squared equals to minus 1 has a profound consequence. It tells you that when you do a time reverse symmetry transformation of the right mover, it becomes the left mover with spin down. But when you do the time reverse transformation of left mover with spin down, it becomes minus right mover with spin up. And that is enforced by the T squared equals to minus 1 property. And that is, if you write down a backscattering term between these two edge channels, it is zero. You cannot have backscattering. If I had spinless fermions, you can simply write down a backscattering term, which will lead the channel to be non-conducting. So this is the special thing about helical liquid. And there's also quite a deep statement you can make, is to say that this type of helical liquid, you can never construct out of a purely one-dimensional model. If you try to construct a lattice model in one dimension, you can never get it. It has to be holographic in the sense that it's the boundary of a two-dimensional liquid. So let me conclude. I discussed the quantum anomalous Hall effect in ferromagnetic insulators. Michael said it's true. We need to find such material, but that's what we as theorists should do. Find materials which are insulators, ferromagnetic, but has a quantized charge Hall effect without any external magnetic field. We have good candidates, but we will interact with both, it requires both band structure calculation and interaction with experiments. And in this very, there's, in nature, there exists a very wide class of material which have these so-called inverted band gap phenomena. In generically, these come from materials such as mercury telluride, and that will have even number of pairs. But you can change even to odd just by applying Rauschbach field in this system. You don't need to go to graphene, and which has a very, very ridiculously small spin orbit gap. And then the quantum spin Hall effect, this is quantum spin Hall effect without Landau levels. You can also create quantum spin Hall effect with Landau level caused by strain gradients. And this, all these quantum spin Hall phenomena implies a new universality class of one-dimensional liquids, which is called helical liquid. So I think in the subject of spin Hall effect, quantum spin Hall effect is really the new frontier. Why? First of all, it's simpler to understand theoretically because you're only dealing with few channels, and you don't need to do this very, very complicated calculation, different tricky order of limits. So it's much cleaner to understand theoretically. It's well classified by global topology, independent of interaction, independent of disorder. It's a well-defined topological classification using the general method of twisted boundary condition, but apply now to spin. It's easier to detect experimentally. Why? Because when you turn on and off these channels, these are just charge channels, and just by counting, the longitudinal conductance you can know, because the system doesn't have a time reversal symmetry. By just turning on and off, you know the existence of the edge states. So, and it's purely intrinsic. It's purely coming from the band structure. And that's the value of intrinsic spin Hall effect, because we can, of course, control band structure much better than we control disorder. And so therefore, there are very well, like you can tune how big the gap is, how big the electric field. And by tuning the gap, we can know by how big the electric field you need to apply by going between these even and odd channels. So this whole subject of band structure engineering, I think, can be now extended to topological band structure engineering by changing the topological properties of the band. And I think most importantly, for practical application, it enables spintronics without spin injection and without spin detection. Okay, so if we look at these edge channels, their most remarkable property is already manifested in the charge conduction. We don't need to talk about spin injection and spin detection. And that, in many ways, I feel that it's the only hope for spintronics to work, because it's just very, very difficult to get spin injection and spin detection.
Yeah, you made a point about the empirical character of the Lettinger equation, this K.S-tron. But you also require a gap, which you're going to induce by going to two dimensions.
Yeah.
As soon as you go to two dimensions, either the coronal or the string, you quench the orbital angle in the growth direction. You no longer have a spherical character in the upper and lower bands.
No. This is like when you do the two-dimensional Hall gas, right? The plus minus 3/2 is still degenerate. The helicity.
Yeah, but I think you...
So you get, basically, you get...
your vector. Yeah. That in fact, the local quantization axis is following you, which happens when you have this...
Yeah, you just need this most general topological... No. So in the presence of two dimension, it's described by this Hamiltonian. If you have mirror symmetry, it is described by this Hamiltonian.
Yeah, so Tsu-Sheng, I'll bet you $1.
Yeah. Only $1.
A bottle of the best Texas wine. that there are no edge states in inverted gap semiconductor quantum wells. And, so the thing that's uncertain about this is that you start with the K.P theory, which describes the band edge.
Yeah.
But really the topological property that you get here comes from the full Brillouin zone of this model.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty sure, just doing the calculation in my head, that if you take a K.P continuum model of an inverted gap semiconductor quantum well, there are no edge states. And so that means if there are edge states...
If you restrict to four bands, there are certainly edge states.
I don't think so. In the continuum theory.
In the continuum theory, is a little bit ill-defined. You need to go to a tight binding model.
And but, because
the formula integrates
the
entire...
tight binding model is not this tight binding model.
Right. So that's one still, it's a good bet to have. So I would bet even more. But there's California Napa, But even if there are many bands, even when there's interactions, the twisted boundary condition classification is still, it's much more general.
Classification.
So the question is what the number pops out to be. In this case, we're doing the calculations right now. I'm very confident it is.
What do you mean this case?
I'm very gap semiconductor.
A real material.
Yeah.
Real inverted band gap semiconductor. Yeah. But there's a lot, so one is this class, but then there's also things like bismuth, which we're looking at, which are very hopeful. I'm just trying to say that there's general theories, general classifications, and it has to be an accident that this kind of thing does not occur.
Anywhere.
It's anyway, generically.
One sort of general. And I think it's a real interesting thing to look for examples of this in nature.
Yeah.
graphene, I'm not absolutely certain about graphene, but graphene probably is an example.
Yeah.
And there may be other.
But this general we talked about yesterday, or the day before yesterday, about the non-possible, whether there's a clean topological classification of it. Mm-hmm. And the answer is definitively yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Danny.
Maybe at least I think it's being discussed. There are spin currents involved here.
Yeah.
Around the Arrhenius definition of the spin current.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very good question. Yeah, so I claim that's the issue we resolve now. No, but so in order to, so you know that in the case, for example, if we do a charge twist here, we know that it can, because of charge current is conserved, a twist at the boundary is the same as doing very little twists in the bulk. That's a unique feature of associated with a conserved quantity. For spin, for example, if you did a twist at the edge, you cannot do this by infinitesimal, a very, very small twist extending all the way to the bulk. It is but the classification to have this under the twisted boundary condition, under the most general condition, has to come out to be integer. So the question really is, what's the difference between one case where the quantity you're twisting is conserved, and in the other case, the quantity you're twisting is not conserved? And that's something we understand the full physical content of. And the content is, if the bulk under the twisted boundary condition, if it gets a non-zero Chern number, let's say you get one, what does that imply? It implies you always have to have gapless edge states. But it does not have to be gapless edge states with open boundary. So if I can do twist, I can do a twist with R. R generally doesn't have to be one. So for any R less than one, there has to be an edge state. But in the case of charge, you can prove it's at I equals to zero. True open boundary condition. When in the case of non-conserved spin current, you still prove that there has to be edge states, but for R less than one, that's not necessarily has to be at I equals to zero. That's the physical content.
Yeah, I don't know, no matter what the definition of the spin current is, essentially, you're saying you get.
Yeah, you get this effect at R less than 1. It does not, the distinction now between conserved and non-conserved is that in the case of conserved, having a non-zero topological number has to imply there's a edge state with full open boundary condition.
Right, but what I'm wondering is then what is the spin curve which flows
And if you use the conventional spin current definition,
this statement is a universal statement that if you have any gapped system, any system with a gap, this number has to be integer. Yeah. And let's investigate the case where this integer is non-zero.
I'm ready to accept
yeah.
it, but
yeah.
Still again, I wonder then, you know, what the experimental is to be measured.
Because, yeah. Okay. So then, I have another paper in preparation. This is this paper. I now claim that the spin current, as we have calculated, can be directly measured in the bulk in experiment.
But is this his definition when he
talks about spin current? I'm not sure if his definition, but my definition of the spin current is the following. So.
Only his definition satisfies your
Gaussian. Yeah.
If you use a different definition.
No, but I will care. I will tell you a very clear physical measurement. So the topological classification is a slightly different question than how to measure the spin current. So maybe I can just spend 1 minute to tell you that spin current in the bulk itself is a directly measurable quantity. How do you measure, how do you define the spin current? So let's say we in the Landau theory, N of K, the charge occupation number as a function K, is detectable. And a charge current simply corresponds to a P wave component for N of K. If you integrate N of K over momentum K, that amount is charge current. So now, if you have an even spin distribution, S of k, and it has a P wave component, that definition of a spin current is directly measurable, because according to general Boltzmann theory, any moments of either the spin or charge is measurable. And we are now proposing an experiment to directly measure. And that's at least, is, we may argue about numerical proportionality constant, but that at least is non-zero when the case spin Hall effect is present.
And, to reach macroscopic quantity in Maxwellian equation, we'll have this spin current.
Yeah. Yeah.
Only
yeah. So the presence. I know the answer. The presence of spin current will, of course, not modify Maxwell's equation. However, it will modify in the Maxwell equation the relationship between D and E. D and E. The relationship between D and E is modified in the presence of spin current, and there's a direct physical consequence of that.
But in all magneto-electric phenomena,
yeah.
This relation between D and E,
yeah.
which also can include B, is modified in all magneto-electrical phenomena.
Magneto-electric. This is no magnet.
It's induced by electric field.
This one has no magneto-electric effect. There's no magnetic, no time reversal symmetry breaking.
So it will be connection between
D and E. Yeah.
B will not
enter. No. Because this system does not have.
What kind of change? Should it
be besides usually we
what is the difference between the usual electric constant and the modified electric constant?
It's just
two quantities,
yeah.
D and E,
yeah.
are related to a tensor of second rank with general thermodynamical limitations imposed on it. So what should be the distinctive property of epsilon ij which makes difference for usual media and media with spin current?
So it has to come from, of course, the dependence of spin currents on physical controls, right? If you change physically control and change the spin currents, you will see that change manifested in the difference between D and E. And that's in principle precisely predictable.
You can stay more.
Going back from spin currents to the more basic question,
it's
topological question.
Please,
One thing confuses me, I mean, once you're using, you're adding spin into the boundary condition,
yes.
the Hamiltonian doesn't conserve spin.
Right.
I might think of a more general thing. You know, I could take a 10 orbital type binding model.
Right.
Put some arbitrary 10 by 10 matrix into the boundary.
Yes.
And that way define infinite, huge number
yes.
of different turn numbers.
Yes, yes.
The question is whether these all have physical significance in the sense, are they, I'm not sure exactly what one means, we can ask that.
Yeah.
For instance, are they robust?
Yeah.
Are they actually bulk properties?
Yes.
Or do they depend
absolutely.
On the geometry of the sample?
Yeah. That's because that's a topological theorem, and it's independent because as long as you have a gap, as long as the perturbation you add is independent, it does not destroy the gap. It is robust. The question is, what is the physical?
Changing system sizes, that's not a continuous change of the Hamiltonian, right? So there's no guarantee that
Changing what?
When you have something which is a topological integer, you know, if I make smooth change, can't change.
Right.
But if I, you know, change my systems like by one lattice constant in one direction, it's not smooth change from the Hamiltonian. I don't see that that's obviously protected. It's not clear something defined on a finite system. There's some funny boundary condition.
It requires
always a bulk property.
It requires that in the thermodynamic limit there's still a gap.
I don't that see makes connection, but why is it how do you connect the gap to the independence of this integer on specifics of your
Then your question is even independent of whether the quantity you define is conserved or not.
No, I suspect it's with
more general, right?
With conservation, you can argue that that's true, because you can replace the twist at the boundary with something which
is smoothly varying. So it turns out it's exactly
But
that's the power of the theorem. It tells you that as long as this number is non-zero, it always have to imply gapless edge states. Well, whether you actually, I will define precisely what do I mean, but it's
edge
when they're turning.
May not be indicative of bulk physics.
But this integer, as long as there's a bulk gap to have this integer protected, that's just a mathematical theorem.
That's fine, but you can define integers in very small finite systems, it's not indicative of many.
Right. So only way for this to be robust is in the thermodynamical limit that you have a bulk gap. For many body wave functions.
It's not obvious that it's sufficient.
As you change this parameter twist, if every point of you twisting the parameter, first of all, you're twisting slowly compared to the gap.
I understand that, but that's a separate question. Okay, let's give 10
minutes. Thanks, Sultan, for the motivation. It's a very nice talk, man. And Steve Carr is well motivated, right? And I want to talk about this one thing, the speed current. And I try to tell you that there is a proper definition and the only one. The real genuine speed current. And this is based on two papers. One is Gale, and there's some of the details actually left out in the ColumnNet version. Also, the author of the authors changed because this took a long time, and eventually, she is actually he. I took over and read most of the contribution, this job is another job.
the Shouchen. There are many Zhangs. I think there's another one, famous in Missouri.
There's one more in Texas.
It's the most popular name in the
world. 6 or 7% of the people in China are Zhangs.
It's very popular.
There was an earlier paper by Mimi Kocher, Sinova, and Zinzing, Timur's ally. So this is some of classical theory. It's somewhat limited in scope, but the idea is to trace back to that.
For spin Hall
effect, we predicted quite some years ago, mostly based on the extrinsic mechanism, and recently, 3 or 4, also predict the intrinsic effect, and without a motivator, huge amount of theoretical work. I think 200 or 300 papers have been written, maybe 200 papers, but there are only three experiments so far, and here are two of them, and readers take great pride that have inspired experimentalists to measure this. However, there's a logical gap. And the speed current calculated the whole problem, which we, all those 200 papers have been done, is not necessarily related to the string accumulation in the boundary of the sample. It's the experimental measure.
Okay. But the speed current is in the bulk itself can be measured.
Not been measured yet.
But
it's not measured by the experiments.
Right.
So I mean, we're not so this there's still a big gap between theory and experiment. Alright? And for two reasons. One is that the spins can be generated locally, especially at the boundary, where symmetry is sufficiently low, right? We can always generate spin density by energy field or wherever the symmetry is sufficiently low, even in the block. In the samples that experiments will use, we do not have spin generation with this Z component in the block. But it was due to symmetry reasons. But the boundary symmetries are broken, therefore, you can generate spins locally. Okay. And the spins can relax very differently at the boundary than in the block. So we try to connect block spin current to spin accumulation boundary is a very frustrating business. And one calculation, you get this relationship, in another calculation, you get another, and so on. And generally, I think there's no unique relationship. So work needed. The theorists need to work out boundary spin accumulation for specific boundaries. And there are already a lot of work going on. Some people, I think Alan, this group has done some calculations for the sharp vacuum boundary, and they found some kind of relationship between the intrinsic spin current we predicted before and this mean accumulation. And there's some other people who use other kind of boundary conditions and so on.
So can I ask a question to Alan? So you can numerically compute the spin accumulation. Is it very sensitive to boundary condition, or maybe at least the sign sensitive to boundary condition?
We only do one boundary condition.
One boundary condition.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah. Because the area has now become a very important issue.
Yeah, it's a very important issue, yeah. And I think Basarmas, who is Zurich, he was here last year, earlier. Actually, we have a paper that shows explicitly the very boundary condition and the current spin accumulation changes. Right? And then, so we need to work out the specific boundaries, and they really go to the microscopics, all right? And then to get the spin accumulation. So in this sense, spin accumulation in the boundary is not really a bulk property. When we talk about bulk contribution at the most, but it's a very specific, boundary specific contribution that can become. The one kind of boundary in the sharp boundary and the shallow boundary, that's a data beach, right? And what experimentalists need to do, confirm the theory, say, this for the 200 papers. And they need to go to the bulk, right? The bulk of the ocean, right? To do something. To find good ways to measure the spin current in the bulk.
These theories probably can also help them. So this is one purpose for my talk here is to point out something. For that,
And for this purpose, we need a proper definition of the spin count. First of all, I'd like to just tell you from the beginning, what is the proper definition? Okay. And this conventional definition is simply the spin operator times the velocity operator, the average over your states. That's your conventional. And which is very reasonable because the charge current, okay, is just the charge times the velocity, right? And we have been using that for years. And there's an alternative, right? You can take the total derivative of the spin displacement operator. So that's an R and an SC. And this is also very reasonable because for the charge current, you can stick in E, you get the same result. So we have been using. Right? So both are not contradicting with things we have been using for charge transport. But which one is the correct one? And the most reasonable one. These are different in general because the spin operator is not conserved. SV dot, which is defined by the commutator with Hamiltonian, it's not zero in general. So for this charge case, they're the same. For spin, they're not.
So is it clear that R times S itself is worth playing in a metal?
In the system where there is no, the average pop is zero in the bottom. And so our study were generally motivated by considering this sort of spin continuity equation. There's not really a continuity equation. Continuity equation with a curve on the right hand side, we call the torque density. And this is actually an exact expression that has a microscopic expression for each of those terms. The S here is the conventional spin current. And the tau z is the torque. When you apply an electric field, you can certainly generate a torque density in the bulk, provided the signature is low enough. There are series down before an experiment done in recent years. And that seems to be probably a more dramatic effect than the Steve Hall effect, the bulk effect. On the other hand, even if the symmetry does not allow bulk torque generation, it still is possible to generate some kind of grading term in the torque. So that when you average zero in the bulk, it may end up something in the boundary. Or when the bulk is not homogeneous on the statistical sense. Okay. So the electric field can in general produce a term which what we call a torque dipole density. Okay. And just like electric field cannot produce a charge, say an insulator, right? In a bulk insulator, but nevertheless can produce charge polarization. Right? Here, why not a torque polarization in the bulk? And in fact, the symmetry property between T tau and the spin current, the conventional spin current, is exactly the same. So whenever you can calculate you can generate a spin current in the bulk, you get a conventional spin current in the bulk. Almost always you can generate you can always generate a torque dipole density. The same is just exactly the same. Okay. So
So anytime when I get something that's non-absolute, I can try to KBC, right?
Yeah.
Right down the right hand side, that's gradient of something. Oh, like a divergence of something, right?
Yeah,
but there must be a condition under which.
Actually, there's a minimal condition.
Okay.
If there's an average torque, it just leave there. But there are grading terms need to be considered. There are grading terms need to be considered. And but this is usually ignored. The gradient terms, they appear as prominently as the spin current, conventional spin current term in the spin continuity equation, right? So they should be treated, give a serious look, okay? So of course, one can take a view that, we still stick to the conventional spin current, and we take great care of every possible term on the left hand side.
Yeah,
that's fine. Yeah.
What about B? Its curl equals zero, or we should not care about the curl of B?
Okay. This will become the curl this moment I do not specify. Yeah. I just require this to be a property of the material. Yeah, and usually that implies actually cannot require the curl to be zero as well. You require this to be a property of the material. So one possibility is that we stick to the conventional spin current and we take great care of every possible terms on the right hand side and do our business as usual. That's fine. We should keep, in previous work, probably, I think that this such a possibility of a grading term on the right hand side is ignored. And my message is that this term should not be ignored. First of all, that's genuine. That's independent of the definition or not. And then, okay, let's say, since there are two terms of grading terms, let's combine them together. Right? They behave similarly, they have the same symmetry, and so on. Let's just move that to the left hand side. Leave whatever, the average terms on the right hand side.
So the condition is the three dimensional integral
of
P of Z
of R is 0. Even if it's non zero, I can still leave the average there and move the grading terms to the left hand side.
But then you will no longer be conserved.
Well, yeah, it's not conserved, it's fine.
Right.
I never claim.
Can it be computed for a given system?
For the quantities, eventually I will show you what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah. So when we combine this, then we have an effective new current. Alright? So if you decide not to treat the grading terms on the right hand side, then you must use this new kind. So it's a different kind of a bookkeeping. But emphasize the fact that there is grading term on the right hand side. And this term we call the Koch dipole density, and they discussed the first in the seventh classical theory by Kocher et al. And when we talk about spin accumulation, I think that we always need to come to the spin continuity equation. And this has been used for many occasions. And maybe if you have a external magnetic field that gives the torque and then you add to the right hand side, whatever. And the relaxational, I call this relaxational torque. The torque, this does not necessarily give rise to precession. To say torque is the rate of change of C. That's it. And this has been used frequently in the literature. And so my point is that if we still want to keep using this, we need to actually consider the grading term and move that to the left hand side. Otherwise, this is wrong. And the spin current here may not
be generated by a pure electric field, maybe with some other things as well, due to diffusion and so on. But the gradients turn from right hand side should always be part of that. And so if we can continue to use such an equation, then this of course provide a way to study spin generation, spin accumulation in a bulk, right? How spins move around and disappear, right? And it can also be applied to a boundary which is where the confining potential is slowly varying, like the Gallipoli beach. Right. And it's so slowly varying that at each point you may regard as a homogeneous. Okay, you can apply this theory locally. Right? You can apply this theory locally everywhere, even in the boundary region, in the bottom part of the boundary region, except for the last V3 path. Okay? And you can predict something. For example, the spin accumulation is bounded. If we can believe that in the last mid-free pass on the Greta Beach, there's nothing really happened. Well, I don't know. If we have a shallow enough boundary, I think that's the case. And then you can integrate this all the way to the boundary, and they can predict a spin accumulation based on this. And by the way, this I think in general this ties to come inside here to divide and do the integral here because tell the local polarization time at different points on the vehicle beach may vary slowly, right? And you can do that as well. So that's some kind of definite handle on smear accumulation if you have a shallow enough a boundary. For steep boundaries, I don't know what to do. Okay.
I'm going to ask a question in the second iteration. I mean, how rigorous is this type of iteration? Does it also include the spin realization via momentum?
I'm not sure. The form of the relaxation has to be that. It can be more complicated. So the point is that whatever you have, a uniform torque in the bulk, and you have to live there. I cannot do anything about this. And all I can do is just move the gradient curve to the right hand side. So that part of the theory, of course, it requires a good adaptation.
So maybe
that
can be subtracted experimentally, the global
stuff. Yeah, I think the experimental fluids have some good, relatively good understanding of what this uniform, then the bulk torque usually are. But I'm not sure how the status of the theory. Hey, Alan?
I was just going to say, how do you distinguish a divergence of P and S over tau?
Yeah, if there's an S over tau, it should divergence of that. You mean the divergence of P and S over tau.
Right. But you...
Experimentally?
Theoretically.
Okay. So the way we calculate this divergence curve is to calculate a momentum-dependent or wavelength-dependent response to the torque to the electric field. And from that, we extract this torque type.
So divergence of P is an intrinsic effect.
Yeah, right.
That's
intrinsic. You can also have some extrinsic. I really don't distinguish intrinsic. Do not want to have the burden to carry the controversy of between intrinsic and extrinsic here. So that's just the from the momentum wavelength dependence of the torque response to the electric field. If you really want to study an electric field generators in current, for other purposes, you have to be different probably.
Okay. And so these are, since we're having most interesting in scenic dimensions, that's why I put those first. But I don't think that should be the only thing, only criteria for defining a scene current. I think there are more general criteria and probably more relevant criteria. One criteria is if we introduce steam current, we can ask, is there a force? Is there a force on current? So that's the force times current gives you power dissipation. And if you have a Zeeman field gradient in your system, and there will be a curve in the Hamiltonian which looks like this. Right? So the gradient times R, that's like the Zeeman field, right? And times S, that's the Zeeman energy. Okay. But don't ask me how to get that gradient. the G factor gradient plus the Zeeman field or whatever. Okay. Maybe you can get those gradients. And you can make this time dependent or whatever. And again, I do not want to burden myself to the subtleties of DC limits. Okay. And because the question of spin current still exists in the AC case. Right? And certainly in the AC conductivity, the intrinsic spin Hall effect is well established. I think there's not much controversy there. And so we can consider, AC spin forces, right? Okay. So here's a spin displacement, and some people call spin dipole operator. Okay? And so when you have a Zeeman field gradient, you naturally have a term in Hamiltonian that couples the spin force to this spin displacement operator. And then it is natural to define a spin current to be the derivative of this operator that couples the spin force. And when you do that, then you can show that if there's a spin current, then the power dissipation due to the spin current can be reproduced, just like in the electric field case, the electric field times the charge current, but in the spin current case, just this. And but such thing cannot be discussed within the conventional spin current, because I cannot write the conventional spin current as a time derivative some operator which couples to a force, to a parameter in the system. The force is just a parameter. Okay, and by the way, this result itself provides, in principle, a measurement for spin current. If you can have a handle on the spin force, right, which has a clear meaning, right, and you can measure the tiny, teeny little bit of heat generated by the spin current, that provide a measurement of the spin current. And while this kind of measurement does not exist for the spin current, so for the conventional spin current, but only for this redefined spin current. And there's...
What about the equilibrium, where there may exist spin currents, and if the system is non-homogeneous, there should be such a force.
Well,
there should be no dissipation.
Yeah.
So
in that case, there must be
left hand side.
there can be other forcing forces, not just this kind. Maybe the gradient of a state-dependent potential, for example.
Okay, another thing that we're using the general theory of transport, linear response transport, we have this wonderful relation, an outside relation.
Let's put the spin transport and charge transport on equal footing. Say we have the spin current, charge current generated by combination of forces, spin force and electric force. Right? And we have a spin charge conductivity tensor. So then that's the spin conductivity tensor, the charge conductivity tensor, and these are cross transport tensors. The spin Hall effect, I think, is talking about this tensor. The response of the spin current to the electric field. And there's a reciprocal or reverse spin Hall effect that discuss the generation of this charge current due to spin force. And the outside relation, there's outside relation in the EC limit, it has this form. And this is just detected by this. When you're calculating, can be written this way, right? The unprepared plus the forces times the displacement operators, you can do linear plus trivially and show the outside relations on the tool formula. And this minus sign because I think this curve so change under universal symmetry. Different language than usual. And then such an outside relation can only be established using the cannot be established using the conventional current. Because the conventional current cannot be traced this way. Cannot do derive a Kubo formula like this.
Yeah, but I guess it can be defined in macroscopic systems, for example, yeah? It depends, because here you're talking about that, but if you talk about macroscopic systems, then you can get on Zagan relation without a problem.
Measure
the stuff in the leaves, which are now
So you have right now paper describe a region, macroscopic region that has leads. But in the leads, there are no stability coupling. You see, you can address your problem through the spin currents in the leads. Since there's no spin coupling, stability coupling, and then, we don't need to worry about this problem. But if there's a stability coupling in the leads, then they have to be careful. Okay.
And then, So what is the spin called inverse spin Hall effect? Some people call it reciprocal spin Hall effect. It's the same. It's a transverse charge current induced by spin force. Apply the spin force in the X direction, you get a charge current in the Y direction. such a thing. And if because this can be measured, and this is relatively probably, it's well defined because the spin force probably do not have to dispute about this. And the charge currents we know very well, right? So I think to measure this. And then the outside relation tells you that once this is measured, we also know the spin hole connectivity. And then when we do a spin call, in fact, since this is known and the electric field, so you can know, right? And then therefore that provides a determination of the spin current, or spin call current.
So that's another kind of a possible measurement of the spin current. Actually, this is used actually implicitly or explicitly, depending on the opinion, is discussed actually in Kirsch's paper. Okay, and how about numbers, right? So these are, we have different definitions. How about numbers? How different the numbers eventually look like? This is the table that existed in the Condorcet version 4 of paper, but the removed in the PRL version under the insistence of a referee B.
Who, after all, might be present?
That's a referee B.
Stand up.
I think that it's actually a good suggestion, because we were so much burdened by the intrinsic, intrinsic controversy. It's actually good to leave this behind, and so it still exists in the last version before PRL, and we still stand by it. This is a simple calculation. No sign errors. Okay, but
that's the symbols.
Yeah. So that's the conventional spin hole connectivity, and that's the extra term due to the quark dipole density. Okay, and that's the
total.
Yeah, the new spin hole. Yeah, for the Rush ball and the KQ Rush ball, which is reverse side. But this case is more subtle. Yeah. And this, by the way, has been confirmed also in this work. Well, of course, they consider disorder, but they along the way, they also did a clean calculation, confirm the results there. And then, so this is a work by Sugimoto and Rao, and it's still in the CondorMAT. I think at one time this paper is called the no-go theorem for spin hole effect. But probably under the insistence of referee C, and they changed it to this title. And so these are the results. Okay. So for the Rochebaugh model, so this is the result. No matter what you do, you get zero. So the zero connectivity, as long as you have some disorder, no matter what you do. So that's zero to the 37th power, zero to the 38th power. It's zero, right? And and for a while we were very upset about that, but so I think it's fine, we can live with it. And besides, these are really, talking about the sticky region of the DC transport. Right? For AC transport, it's not much problem. And if you use our new speed current, you'll find that you do use empirical potentials of this kind, you find zero. If you use the general spin disorder potential, you find within the leading form approximation and the finite compiler. For the cubic Rochebaugh, it is finite for every case. The cubic Rochebaugh means, the one that we discussed, and it's all finite. But it's a new definition. You get zero, and so the status from the Rochebaugh, the QB Rochebaugh, is the same under the new speed current. But unfortunately, we don't know what happens for the 3D models yet. Maybe they're doing the calculation one. And Professor Rochebaugh told me that there was also a paper by Kleinert and Bryson, right? Yeah.
Briggs and Kleinert.
Kleinert. And they, they.
And you have it.
And I have it. I got your cat with me, and they, it's a, the conclusion is actually similar to this, except for a last formula. I don't know, for some reason they consider clearly that we got some strange result, but I think it's from pragmatic. Anyway, so the disordered case has been calculated for using the new spin current, and they predict different results for the spin hall connectivity.
But this since Hendrik and I, it is your definition.
This is your new definition. Yeah.
But this is your definition. You came to a different result, not to zero.
Oh, our calculation in the previous table was just
a little bit of a change.
This is
the calculation is zero.
Yeah.
What's
the story?
What's the orange?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is what we calculate. We just use the Kubo formula, right? The set temporary disorder, whatever, and this is dual calculation. Just like what we used to do for the using the conventional spin current. Disorder free calculation. Yeah. But it's a simple calculation, but that's why we did it. And but turns out these results are unstable against disorder. Yeah.
So
in the DC limits. In the DC limits.
Using the conventional definition, we showed just a little bit.
Yeah. But the conventional is stable for the cubic rush bar. But in this case, it's unstable for both models.
So with your definition, when different calculational techniques are applied, the final result differs. Yeah.
No.
Or not.
Yeah.
So why you have?
Well, here we just didn't no vortex correction, nothing.
Kubo formula and so.
Oh yeah. Clean.
But Sugimoto came to differ, and his collaborators came with the same definition to
a same definition. Yeah, but they have a disorder, then but they carefully consider the limits of the disorder goes to zero. So they have disorder, this doesn't have disorder from the very start. So same definition, different result, because executed calculation is differently. So there's a the Donaldson condition is really genuine difference, like just the treatment of disorder differently.
AC is okay.
AC, I think it's okay. Yeah, AC, I think that everything should be smooth with this one. Yeah, the DC limit is kind of good. Okay, how about spin hall insulators? Well, Xu Cheng discussed some elegant examples and introduced this concept of a spin hall insulator, which is a charge insulator, okay, with a zero turn number, but can have a spin hall effect. However, all insulators with spin orbit coupling are spin hall insulators. Okay. If we use, if we stick to the conventional definition. So this is also a spin hall insulator. Myself probably spin hall insulator. So if we stick to the conventional definition. Here are some examples. The undoped intrinsic semiconductor zero temperature, and you can calculate for spin hall connectivity, non-zero and actually quite sizable. But this is based on the conventional definition. And with the new definition, we haven't resolved the problem completely, but we have one important achievement. That is, when all eigenstates are localized, like in the other simulator, you can show explicitly the Spin-Hawking activity has vanished. But the proof is actually very simple. You start with this, okay. Remember, this is the density current, okay, that's a total time derivative, right? Whenever you have a total time derivative, you can, that's a commutator with the Hamiltonian. You stick that commutator into the Hamiltonian, you calculate the metric element, you end up with something like this. And this is a total derivative, so you can also do this one. And usually this is not permissible, right? Because there are x and y variables are not well defined if the states are extended. Okay. But if the states are localized, this is a valid operation. So you can do it, but then after a few steps, you end up with this. Just the average of the commutator of SVX with y over the occupied states. This commutator, of course, vanishes. And I think David Thales once told me when I was a graduate student, he knew of a professor who can prove all conductivities must vanish. By using tricks like this. I think Shufen and Zhang probably made such a mistake. I think they made such a mistake in their PIL article, like claiming that the skin, choosing a skin hole that like, must vanish doesn't contribute. I think they need something like this. We actually had a comment in our, slightly our, reference. And then, then the question is, how about band insulators, where the eigenstates are not really localized? Well, there are localized random functions, but they are not eigenstates. The problem is trickier, and we still do not have a handle. But we can show. I think Murakami gave a talk over the March meeting. For my students, that's you can use the scalar formula, and to calculate the sinkhole connectivity on insulators. Since there's a gap, I think that's a well defined thing, and the result agrees with this new definition for sinkhole. Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So my talk has been mostly conceptual, right? So I don't talk about. And so this new spin current is this spin current, conventional spin current plus a torque dipole density, which comes from a gradient term on one hand side of the continuity equation, which should always be taken seriously. And no matter what. And then this turns out can also be written as a time derivative of a spin displacement model. And when we consider spin continuity equation, at least in some approximation, like in this form, and maybe some other pop curves here, and then this J, we remove those gradient terms here, then this J must be the new current. And this has been used for bulk discussions simulation. And this can also be used even for boundary spin simulation with a shallow confinement, later beach confinement. And with this new spin current, we can define the spin force so that the spin current can, in principle, be measured from a fifth generation. Yeah. And similarly, you can have an ensemble relation, and which can be used together with the inverse spin hole effect to measure the spin current as well. And the result are altered on spin-hole conductivity because of the spin-hole effect. The sign reversal of the intrinsic values, intrinsic means the vanishing values with infinitesimal disorder, the bleeding order of perturbation. And then there are no spin Hall effect in simple insulators.
In Anderson's?
Anderson's insulators. There can be spin Hall. Thank you very much.